Hi, Undisclosed listeners. I just wanted to do a little bit of a pre-roll here before we get into this week's episode. This week's episode features a guest who spent many, many years in prison for a crime he did not commit. Even after his release, he has spent many, many more years trying to be fully exonerated. Our guest today is 80 years old, and he is in ill health, and you're going to hear this throughout our interview. So I just want to give you a little bit of a heads up to have some patience. His story is valuable. His fight for a full exoneration is valuable. And even though it might be a little bit hard to listen to sometimes, I promise you, it'll be worth it. Hi, and welcome back to Undisclosed Towards Justice. This is our weekly episode where every week we like to present a new case to you guys. I'm here, as always, with my colleague, Colin Miller. Hey, Colin, how you doing?
Doing great. How about yourself?
I'm well, thank you. This week, I'm interested to present like this case that came to us through our contact form, sent to us by the sister of a defendant who went through a very difficult experience in the criminal legal system, who fought to be exonerated for many years and who is still fighting to be exonerated, even though he's no longer in prison. I'm going to just give you a little bit of the facts of the case, then introduce our guests and take it from there. In 1976, January 16th, 1976, 47-year-old Richard Kreusler opened his door of his Palm Beach home and he was shot and killed. He died actually 13 days later. And in those 13 days, he didn't identify the killer. And then about 2 years later, a man named Mark Herman was arrested for this murder. And in that same year, he was convicted of it. I'd like to welcome our guest today, Mark Herman himself and his sister, Julie Gibson. Hi, Mark and Julie.
Hi.
Hey, team.
How you guys doing?
We're doing great now. Somebody will get to hear us.
Well, we're happy to have you on. Now, you know, our listeners might remember we had presented a case, the Nelson Serrano case. And Nelson Serrano was the oldest man on death row in the state of Florida. Nelson had passed away, but we still found it important and valuable to have his son on to talk about the case and why it was so important for his family and his son for them to still get justice for their father, because he died in prison. He was never exonerated. He was never released. And likewise, in this case, we have a situation where even though Mark is no longer incarcerated, has not been for a long time, the family is still seeking exoneration. So I want to first say, Julie, you're the one who reached out to us, right?
Yes.
Can you talk a little bit about your role in Mark's advocacy?
Well, after he had his denial from the CRU, I just thought everything needed to be compiled in a way that all the evidence was presented from A to B, all the way to M, from every single thing that happened to him, so that it could be presented to the right people and they could see the injustice. And so that was my role. I just was so passionate about the injustice that I wanted to help in whatever way I could.
Okay, so Mark, I want to ask you, first of all, can you tell us a little bit about how you got on the radar of the police 2 years after the murder and were arrested for it?
They were catching all kinds of heat because they couldn't solve the case. And this was first time anybody in Palm Beach or Millionaires Row had ever been attacked in their home. So they were, as I understand it, stressed out to try to solve the case. They had, as I understand, all the snitches they had in the whole town trying to run around and find out, you know, what they could find out. And I came under the radar because there was this gal that handled all the hookers in Palm Beach that was dealing with the millionaires. And she was a good friend of mine from the bars and knowing people about different things. So she told me about the reward that was out there and how they were offered it. And so I had the guy, Ronnie Gates, which was security for John D. MacArthur, who's John D. MacArthur. He's a millionaire that owns half of Palm Beach. and other real estate around the world. But he was working for one of his hotels, and he was trying to get some of his own charges that he had from the past. His job was to find out people that came into that hotel that were trying to rob people or doing everything to get his charges thrown out. I don't know where my name came in prior to that, except his job was to try to set me up for that because I was leaving town.
Yeah, so Ronnie Gates and Mark were friends in the bouncing business. They were bouncing bars. And so Ronnie Gates got into some trouble where he was arrested. So the police came to him and they were talking about the murder, Rich Crosland murder. And what Ronnie Gates said in an affidavit, also on Geraldo Rivera, was that the cops gave him an ultimatum that would either be him or Mark that would be arrested for the murder. And Ronnie Gates pointed the finger at Mark.
What was the state's theory about your motive? Why would you want Richard Crosland dead?
There was none.
Gates told him that I got the wrong guy.
Right. They never thought that you had a motive to kill him. They said it was mistaken. You went to the wrong house, right? That was the theory?
Right.
And so can you break that down, what their theory was and how that led to you being arrested?
There was a guy that lived next door to Crosland, and he was a drug dealer. He beat some guys on a drug deal, so they hired me to beat him up, do something to him. So I was supposed to go to his house and shoot him, scare him, or something to that effect. And I went to the wrong house. I went to the house that was next door, and shot the wrong guy. So then this guy that lived next door, he went on TV and said, I don't know Mark Herman, never heard of Mark Herman, and I don't live there anyway. My parents live there. I live in an apartment somewhere right there in the city, and if anybody wanted me, they'd just come to my apartment and get me, and go to my parents' house because I don't live there. So that theory, not only because Chrysler's, I guess, was a mansion that had two floors, and the other house was only one floor.
Right. Tough to confuse the two.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mark, when they brought the charges against you, they had Gates, right, as a witness. And he apparently, you said he had some charges pending. Do you know if he ended up getting some kind of plea and was leniency on those charges?
They didn't even charge him. They let him go.
They let him go. Mm-hmm. What about other evidence that the state, what other evidence the state present against you in court?
That was it, except after they arrested me on his testimony, after I was arrested, they found out, he said he overheard a conversation on my phone at my house where a guy called me and told me, well, you got the wrong guy. He said he was there at my house and he listened on the extension without me knowing it. So Then it was found out that I didn't have an extension on my phone. I was leaving town. I had everything already shut off. So the hearing it over the phone didn't work. He said the shotgun I had in my property that I was sending to Florida was the shotgun that killed him. It didn't turn out to be anywhere near the shotgun. One I had was really his first show. It was a chrome 6-shot, 12 gauge. It was a riot shotgun. And that's not what was used on Chrysler because they fired from such a distance. They shot through the door, by the way.
Yeah.
And from the distance that it was, the expansion of the hole in the door showed that it was a long gun. And it was used by a professional. But the technique that they used, I guess, in the service where they shoot the first shot up here, and then the guy went down on his knee and shot the second shot. They're allegedly that, they catch them as they're falling. I had no experience like that in service to do anything like that.
Julie, did you attend the trial?
I attended the appeal. I was only 16 when all of this happened. So, my mom is the one that flew to Florida, attended the trial, which, was the biggest trial in the history of the state of Florida, and it was televised gavel to gavel.
As an early middle-aged woman, I am joined by so many other women across the country who are like, where do we shop? Where do we shop for pieces that are elegant, classic, comfortable, and make sense for us at this stage in our lives? Look, in the last few years, I have been much more intentional about what I wear day to day, leaning into pieces that feel effortless, comfortable, and still put together without having to put so much thought into it. It just makes getting dressed simpler. And that's why Quince has been my go-to. The fabrics are elevated, the fits are flattering, and everything just works without overthinking it. As long as you have the right pieces, you will look like you put in the effort. Quince makes it easy to refresh your everyday this spring with pieces that feel as good as they look. They use premium materials like 100% European linen, organic cotton, and ultra-soft denim. Their lightweight linen pants, dresses, and tops start at just $30, and they are effortless, breathable, and easy to wear on repeat. Look, I know I'm not the only woman out there who's like, can I just get something that doesn't show my midriff and isn't cut out in the back? I want something that's classic, elegant, comfortable, and fits my life right now. And I don't want to pay an arm and a leg for it. Everything at Quince is priced 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They work directly with ethical factories and they cut out the middlemen. So you're paying for quality and craftsmanship, not brand markup. This spring, what I finally did, so long overdue, was purge out all of my jeans. I had so many jeans that just did not make sense for me anymore. The styles didn't make sense, the cuts didn't make sense, and they didn't feel comfortable anymore. So my spring refresh has been replacing those jeans with jeans from Quince. Listen, moms out there, we know the struggle, right? We know the struggle, but Quince has you covered. Quince has every style of jean known to man, from straight leg jeans to slim boyfriend cuts and wide leg jeans and stretch jeans and just, I mean, everything you can imagine, but all their denims are super soft, they're super comfortable, but they still have enough structure and support in the places that we all need it now. And when you see the prices, you are going to do a double take. So refresh your everyday with luxury you will actually use. Head to quince.com/towardjustice for free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. Now available in Canada too. That's quince.com/towardjustice for free shipping and 365-day returns. quince.com/towardjustice.
And Mark, what was that like for you? I mean, this is back in 1978 when coverage of trials was not commonplace at all. And so, I mean, what was this like, this media circus of your entire trial being televised?
It was like watching a movie. I mean, I had to detach myself emotionally.
And in terms of being able to detach yourself emotionally, you mentioned Gates was the primary witness against you, but also the state called a number of people who shared a cell block with you who claimed you confessed, and obviously you didn't. What was it like hearing these former cellmates take the stand and lie and say you would confess to this crime?
On one hand, I couldn't believe it was happening, and on the other, it was like I was watching a movie. I had gone as soon as I got into that jail because Ronnie, they hid him after they found out that everything that he said was lies. So they hid him in another state. They kept him in a hotel room so that we couldn't find him. So once I got into the jail, and first thing I did, and I knew Captain Donnelly from there, and I said, Captain Donnelly, I said, if any of these guys, wherever you put me, come out here and say that I confess to this goddamn thing. I said, they're full of shit. And he said, no, Mark, no, no, we don't have to worry about that. Well, every cell that he put me in, the job was to find somebody in there to say that I confessed while I was in there. And there was nothing I could do about it, you know, other than say what I said and tell my attorney the same thing. So well, they had me in one cell block. That was a lockdown thing. They had another guy in there that was a hitman for the mob. And his job as a head of the cell block, he was the one that brought you your food and all that. His job was to try to get himself off being recommended of death when he gets convicted, because he's pretty guilty for this hit that he did in town. So he went to court one day, and while he was gone to court, they let us out to be able to take a shower and stuff. They had one place where, you know, six of us could take turns taking a shower. And while he was out, because he was always being called out by the captain of the jail mysteriously at different times. So after he was gone, the guys came and told me, "Mark, he's trying to get us to testify against you, that you confess to us." And I said, "No shit." They accidentally left his cell open at the same time. So I went in there and I went through his letters and his file that he had, and he had his letter out from the state attorney and his attorney, where he was making a deal with them that he would testify that I confessed to him. I was in there that they were going to not recommend the death penalty on his case. So how I handled that, I knew no matter whatever I did that he was going to go back in, they were going to blow it up into something that it wasn't. So I did was I put some cheese in that in that envelope from the state attorney and his attorney making a deal. So for lunch that day, we had cheese sandwiches. So I put the cheese in the envelope and put it back in there. And we were locked down in our cells by the time he came back from court. And I guess that's when he testified with a bag over his head, so nobody was supposed to know who he was. And he went in there, and he wasn't in there about 5 minutes, and he started banging on the cell, "Donnelly, Donnelly, help, help." What? He said, "Let me out of here, because they're going to kill me." So They took him back out, and Donnelly.
He realized he had been caught.
Transferred me out of there and transferred me into another cell where another two guys were going to testify that I testified against them, that I confessed to them. Turned out, well, of course, they recanted 3 years later, but they had their charges dropped for testifying against me. So that's where their other evidence came from. Two guys or three guys that am I going through these cells. The captain puts me in another cell. They get another guy. Put me in another cell, get another guy.
Julie, I think one of the most astonishing things about this case is the fact that very shortly thereafter, just a couple of years after, you know, three of these witnesses, these incentivized jailhouse informants, get on Geraldo Rivera, which is arguably the most popular talk show in the country at the time, and they recant on camera. Did you have any idea that was happening, either one of you? How did that come about?
Mark was writing letters, right, to all the media.
Yeah, everywhere. Through his investigation, they went on camera. I didn't know that until I saw it. And we knew the show was coming on, and by then they had me in a cell with more people in it. It wasn't a lockdown cell because they already were, you know, taking me. I don't know if they had trial already. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I had to for them to recant. And everybody jumped out. We were all hooray, hooray. And to hear that they got caught, snitches, you know, recanting stuff. And we had a 5-gallon bucket of homemade wine that we had made up for this show. And we all got drunk. I got so drunk, I fell down, busted my head open from going up and down on the bleachers saying, "Yay, yay." And I cracked my head open, and Captain of the jail came in and apologized to me for these guys. I didn't know, Mark. I didn't know.
Wow.
You didn't know. Come to find out, he gave one of them, the hitman, a TV to watch so that to make sure that his testimony fit in, you know, with the other guys that testified to help him out, because they were kind of close buddies now. Their mafia guys sent him a $5,000, $10,000 pair of golf clubs.
Let me ask you this. So we have Gates, we have the jailhouse informants, they recant on Geraldo Rivera. We have this crazy theory of you were supposed to kill the neighbor in the one-story house and you accidentally killed the victim at his two-story palatial home. I think from what I read at your trial that your defense attorney didn't call any witnesses in your defense or present any evidence. Is that right, that he didn't present a defense case at all?
No, his explanation was that they didn't have a case anyway. He felt that he was a good orator. He figured that he would have to give up two arguments to the jury if he called anybody outside me.
Okay, and what would those two things be that he would have to give up, he said?
He had to give up second arguments.
Oh, okay.
He'd only be allowed one argument.
Uh-huh.
If he calls witnesses, then he's only allowed one argument. If he doesn't call anybody other than me, he gets two arguments.
He gets
first and last. And he felt that was more important than having people go up there and deny stuff that was already proven that it wasn't true.
Were you offered a plea bargain in this case at all?
No.
No, it was just trial or nothing.
No.
Yeah.
Did your attorney present any alibi at all? Do you have any alibi evidence?
I had an alibi, a gal and her husband that said that I was at their house watching a movie that was, I forget what the name of that the movie was.
You did have an alibi, but the alibi evidence was not, the witnesses were not presented. That's what happened.
Right. And they couldn't really say exactly when that, it was within that week. Anyway, and they wasn't, he was afraid that they'd make it look bad, like I was trying to offer something that I wasn't sure of, or was trying to, you know, do something fake.
That's the difficulty, right, is you weren't arrested until 2 years after the murder.
Yeah,
right.
If we go back to that, like, did you have any idea at the time you were arrested that you were going to be arrested, or was this completely out of the blue?
Yeah, out of the blue. I was originally was arrested for, I got a conviction of a marijuana charge. Possession of marijuana and possession of a firearm by a convicted felon, and they gave me 31 years. And from that 31 years, and I'm kind of stuck in there, they come back, now they got a murder to add on to it. And I was like double shocked. I mean, we were expecting the maximum that they would get for possession of marijuana or anything like that was max 5 years. You know, maybe they're going to fight for less. That wasn't with that same attorney. This is with a public defender.
May is Maytag Month, and Menards is passing the savings on to you. You need reliable and energy-efficient appliances to conquer the day. Menards is your one-stop shop with appliances in stock and ready to take home today. Check out our top appliance brands, including KitchenAid, Maytag, Whirlpool, Amana, and Criterion. Save big money on Maytag appliances at Menards. And check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for all the great deals happening now. Save big money at Menards.
Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on two purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit Dick's.com/scorecardplus for details.
You were convicted of the murder. What were you sentenced to then?
Mandatory 25 to life.
And Julie, can you tell us about the Weissman report? Tell us what it is first. Who is Weissman?
Okay, so Weissman is part of the prosecuting team.
The assistant state attorney.
Right? Yes. So he was asked to investigate the case. He started his investigation in October of 78. And didn't finish until 79. If you read the report, he doesn't really implicate Mark.
We had so much public pressure that it wasn't me that did the murder. This has already been convicted. That somebody else that did it. So Bloodworth, the state attorney at the time, sent a team out to satisfy the public pressure to look at this other evidence that these other people may have done it. Anyway, they went out and investigated, and Weissman came back and allegedly, well, Weissman said he did. There's no allegedly there. He said these guys more or less were trying to make a deal. If they told them they'd get them the shotgun, they knew where the shotgun was thrown in, that if they let them, they're the one guy, if he let him be able to tell his story, that would he not go to prison himself? Well, they came back with that report and the blood work. The state attorney said, no, we already got Herman. Forget about that. Don't even bring that up. So, in fact, he says, put in there somehow or another that Herman was a passenger in the car or drove the car or had something to do with it, not the murder itself, but he'd implicate Herman because we got him convicted and they don't want to look bad. And the state attorney that got all this, he's a multimillionaire now because of my case, that he got me convicted. He said, don't get Herman to be found not guilty or that we've got the wrong guy. Then he's going to get money. And then we're going to look bad. So leave it alone. Leave it like it is. We already got him convicted. The case is solved. Everybody's hunky-dory. You know, we're all making money over it. Bloodworth's running for the state attorney himself. He's running for Congress. The judge is running for a higher court. And the sheriff was running for something in the FBI. So they're all running for office, a higher office. And they didn't want to hear about Mark Herman being wrongly convicted because they were all involved in it.
At some point, and I think another really kind of shocking turn of events, at some point, the victim's children become your biggest advocates. Can one of you explain how that happened?
Yeah, one of the victim's kids, she was an advocate for me all the way from the beginning. She didn't think that I had anything to do with it. Now, the rest of the family just went along with the politics of the day. And so she was outvoted. It was a close family. And she was outvoted not to get involved in it. They felt that I did it and leave it alone, you know, let everything be as it is. And she didn't believe it. Well, as things started falling apart, she got involved with finding out what all was really happening. And so when these guys all recanted and told their stories, then she convinced the rest of the family, hey, we're on the wrong track. We need to find out who really killed our father. So they all made a pact that they were going to find the real killer, and that they didn't believe that it was me. And I, after my conviction, I took and offered them that my attorney had a great big box full of all my files, all his files, everything that I ever wrote to him, everything that he did in the investigation. I offered them that file, that whole box, and they could read everything that there was on that case. And they went to Seppi's home, my attorney. At this time, he had, I think, he had died of a heart attack, not too far back past my trial, but the secretary, it was his investigator and his secretary. She held on to that box because she felt that he felt down the line that they were going to attack him. And so he wanted everything in preservation of that he did, investigations that he did, everything that there was to find out. He wanted her to hold on to it in case it ever came back to haunt him. Well, by the time it came back to haunt him, he was passed away. But she retained that in the garage. And I sent a friend of mine down with the Kreusler family, with the Patty, the one girl that never believed it in the beginning. I had contacted Ann, his investigator and receptionist at the time, where the files were, and I asked if she still had them, would she give them to these friend of mine and the Kreusler family so they could see. And she said, I got them, Mark. I've saved them all these years. So they went to Miami and got everything. So they knew everything, ever had anything to do with me or the case or what my attorney found out, all the files. And so now the family got behind me.
They did their own investigation.
Yeah. And Julie, can you tell us how did your brother finally come home? What and how?
Oh, my God. Oh. That first.
Good.
I think I might cry. So he had a fabulous attorney that took his case, and she believed totally in his innocence. And she was able to go to the governor and fight for Mark on behalf of Mark's clemency and get him clemency. This was in 1992. And the governor and the whole cabinet unanimously voted based on Mark's innocence.
For the first time they've ever done that.
Ever in the history of the state of Florida.
Let me tell you the story with Sharon.
And this is Sharon Steadman, right? Sharon Steadman is the attorney?
Yeah.
Yeah.
She was assistant attorney general at one time, and she was the appellate attorney for the chief justice of the 4th District Court of Appeal, or the 5th District, because we were the 4th District. She had a whole new district, and at the time, she heard about my case, and she didn't believe they had the right guy, but it didn't have anything to do with her district. And she had retired from her position. And I guess she wasn't doing anything, but I don't know how this friend of mine that was kind of doing some investigating on the side found out that she was in town. And they had brought up my case. And my friend had gotten through with his girlfriend that talked to her. And she said, well, he's still in prison? I said, yeah. Well, she said, I believe that he had anything to do with that. And they talked her into talking to her law office to let her appeal my case, if they would pay for it, to let her do that. And the guy that was head of their law firm says, have at it, Sharon. Go do your thing. So she did further investigation. They paid for it. The law office paid for it. She found out everything that we were saying was true. And she got the victim's best friend, who was worked for the sheriff's department, to come to court and testify that he didn't think I did it, that he kind of knew what was going on with the victim, because he was a different personality than everybody made him out to be. And I had another private investigator that worked for the family that told what he found out. And they all testified. Three of them testified in front of the clemency board, and they went back and voted to set me free. But they weren't letting me. I had 25 to life plus 31 years.
And you had served at this point 14 years already.
15 years.
Okay. But it wasn't an exoneration, is the thing.
No, but they let me out free. They didn't give me a tale where I had probation or anything like that. They said, set him free. I'm out in the middle of the desert. I said, okay. They let me
time
free.
Time served.
You know, after 15 years. In the meantime, my wife had died. My in-laws had sent my kid off to another family to be taken care of.
That's tragic.
It was really hard.
Julie, let me from that take you back to the impetus for reaching out to us, which is these jailhouse informants recant on Geraldo.
Yes.
There's this compelling testimony before the clemency board, unanimously leading to the release. And so now you go to the conviction review unit at the CRU to try to get an exoneration. And what happens during that process? Can you tell us a bit about the process of going to the CRU and their decision?
Well, I was not there, but Mark went, and the Chrysler family paid for all of his airfare, paid for him to go. They were told that they could show up and be in the room with him. And so when they got there, they were told to wait outside. So Mark had gone in there alone. He's crippled and not doing well. And so there was no one there to advocate for him. And, you know, they just kind of dismissed him.
I went in to tell my story, that what the Cruisers found out, what our investigation showed, that these other guys had something to do with it, and they didn't want to hear it. Well, it's right at the same time that they've got a new state attorney that's going to be taking over the state attorney's office in like 3 months. So they didn't want to make any waves for her. They had her with a pre-designated argument that was so long, I fell asleep at the table while she was... But she was trying to explain why they weren't going to investigate it any further, and why all these other witnesses that was recanting didn't matter anymore. And then she told all these courts that we went to that turned us down about trying to get a new trial, which didn't have anything to do with the argument that that we're making now. This is all new evidence. But they went through all the appeals that I did that they that nobody else wanted to hear it, so why should they? And they turned me down, and the Crucer family was supposed to go in with me, and they had their questions and things that they had already found out in their own investigation that they were going to argue the same points that I would. Well, they didn't want to hear that. At first, they had them coming, then when they paid my way and they were enthused, well, they didn't want to hear it now. They weren't allowed to say anything. You know, if they wanted to say something after I got done, they could come back and tell them their story. So that's more or less how that went.
Mark, how old were you when you were arrested?
31.
How old are you now?
80.
80. And you are still seeking exoneration. Mm-hmm. You guys have not given up. Why is it so important to you?
Well, because of the bad mark that it would make not only to my family, but I have a son that still has my name. And really to watch them feast off what they did to me, which they all knew was wrong. And then they throw their chest out like they're born-again Christian and the state attorney that didn't want anything to be found out because he was the one that was enjoying all the fruits of finding an innocent guy guilty. One of the most important murders in the whole history of Palm Beach or Florida or the United States for that matter. I was the second trial ever televised, gavel to gavel, besides the guy that...
Jimmy Zamora.
Zamora. That was really a farce. It was not only a source of pride, but also for protection of my son, who has my name, and my family that still has to have that ink blot on their name.
Julie, has there ever been a time where you've said, Mark, just let it go now?
No.
Give it up?
No.
Why?
Because I've seen the heartache that he has gone through for injustice. And I can't let go of injustice. This was an injustice. It was evil. It was wrong. And he doesn't deserve to leave this earth with that over his life. He needs to be completely exonerated. And what is right needs to come to light.
What is the mechanism now for an exoneration? Do you have to go back into court? What would it take?
Well, we have to have an attorney, and we don't have the funds for an attorney, because once we go back to court, we need somebody that has the fire, the passion, the belief, and conviction that Mark's case, the merits of his case.
We can't argue the points of law.
No.
We don't know the law that well.
There's no way we would go after this much time to go into court by ourselves would be, you know, would not be good.
I have seen you guys have a petition online for better or worse, and that's something we'd be happy to share with our listeners. But, you know, folks listen to this podcast from different, not just different parts of the country, different parts of the world. There might be somebody in Florida listening who might be interested in taking up this case, and we hope so.
That would be amazing.
I don't think you guys have a website or anything, like if somebody wanted to get more information, do you?
Oh, well, Mark does.
I have the website, but that's just for people to understand my case and actually to donate to my cause just by buying the book that I wrote.
What's the name of that book?
It's Rape Prevention Recipes, and it's got nothing to do with the murder. It's a book I wrote on rape and crime prevention that I wrote while in prison to try to raise the funds to fight my case and the things that I found out because I worked for the
psychology
department. I was the guy that took care of all the records and stuff in there. And when I found out all these guys, and they used to sit around in a camp thing around in the room and tell their stories and things that I found out about people that aren't safe on the street and how the different ways they burglarize the houses or got them as a victim. And I compiled all that information. I put it in a book to raise the funds.
Yeah. I'll be happy to share that link as well with our listeners. Colin, do you have any closing thoughts, questions?
No, I think we covered it all.
Yeah. Well, Julian Mark, when I first met you, I was honestly astonished. I know how long it takes to get justice in this system. And for you guys, it has been an entire lifetime. So I really honor your fight. I appreciate you bringing it to us. I hope our audience is inspired by it. Mark, we're with you, you know, and we hope you get the justice that you deserve.
I would appreciate that.
Thank you guys so much for your time.
Thank you so much.
Holler at us if you need any more broken up testimony.
Hey, Undisclosed listeners. It's Meethal, executive producer of Undisclosed Toward Justice. Before I roll through the credits, I've got a few quick notes. By now, most of you probably know about our Facebook community group. If you haven't joined yet, please go to facebook.com/groups/towardjustice and answer 3 simple questions and you're in. But seriously, answer the questions because a bunch of you are still pending since you've only answered 1 or 2. They're easy questions, I promise. In addition to engaging with us through the Facebook group, you can also leave us a voice note at speakpipe.com/undisclosed. We always check the messages, and so far, I think we've answered all of them. We also have a Patreon page with 3 different tiers of perks, the lowest one just being $1, which allows us to continue to do this work. Other tiers include bonus episodes, early access to merch, and even joining Rabia in a live true crime Zoom discussion. Just go to patreon.com/undisclosedpod. Now, onto the real credits. A huge shout out to Hannah McCarthy for audio production. Thank you to Patrick Cortez and Ramiro Marquez for our theme music. For anyone new here, you can engage with us online by going to Instagram or Facebook at Undisclosed Podcast. We're also on TikTok, YouTube, and X at Undisclosed Pod. Whether you're a new or returning listener, you can always check out our previous cases and bonus episodes by going to our website at undisclosedpod.com. If you would like to follow Colin and Rabia on social media, you can find Rabia at RabiaSquared2 on Instagram and Colin at EvidenceProf on Instagram, X, and Blue Sky. Thank you all for your continued support and for supporting all of our sponsors. Until next time.